I want to make sure that in discussing this and having these exchanges, that it remains patently clear that I haven't made up my mind about anything in this case. But I'm trying to play devil's advocate so that I can hopefully come to a sound conclusion about whatever decision that I ultimately make. The jury's still out. Pardon the pun. All right. Rebuttal time? 10 minutes for the Farleys?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just move quickly, Your Honor. First off, I think it bears noting that today the plan administrator has told you exactly how it interprets its plan. Spouse means one man and one woman. Mistaken, non-mistaken, what have you, he's interpreted his plan. That means that Ellen Farley was not married, according to this plan. That means that the Farleys are entitled to the benefits that their daughter, Ellen, set aside for them. Moreover, according to the U.S. Supreme Court precedent...
Let me just ask one question.
Okay.
When you say that that means that Ellen Farley was not married...
According to the plan.
According to the plan, excuse me. Are you saying then that just because, or even though, Cozen did not have a bona fide marriage certificate in its possession, or was not aware that those steps had been taken by Ms. Farley, that that means that there was no marriage?
I don't know that I exactly
understand. Let me rephrase.
Sure.
You said that what's been demonstrated is that there was no marriage. And the other side has presented evidence that obviously there was a marriage, arguably. So how can Cozen say, or you say, that there was no marriage as far as Cozen is concerned, unless it's because Cozen wasn't aware of, or it was illegal, or not recognizable?
Well, at least in interpreting the plan provision of the word spouse, married for 1 year prior to the death, Cozen has said today that that means an opposite-sex marriage, traditional marriage,
okay,
protected under DOMA. They were looking to fall within the bounds of DOMA. And U.S. Supreme Court precedent, 2010 Conkright versus Frommert, 130 S Court SCT 1640, pinpoint site 1646, the plan administrator's interpretation of its plan, quote, will not be disturbed if reasonable, end quote. That's longstanding precedent of the U.S. Supreme Court. Moreover, the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of DOMA doesn't impact the terms of this private contract between the employer and the employee with that now established. DOMA doesn't force employers and employees to contract in this way. ERISA and the IRS code don't force employees and employers to contract in this way. And I do want to say, even to the point of the Human Rights Campaign, that somehow this is an unreasonable interpretation, even though backed up by DOMA, et cetera, and the fact that both Illinois law and Pennsylvania law felt that this relationship that was brought forth in Canada was invalid at the time of its consummation and at the time of the death of Ellen Farley, determining whether a person is married or divorced is an issue of state law. And that was somewhat conceded here by the Human Rights Campaign. It's not preempted by ERISA. And that's that Comerica case that we've been citing to the court. That's the 2006 Westlaw 382-50-68, page 8. Counsel for Ms. Tobitz had stated that federal law preempts the determination of what state tells you who's married, who isn't. The problem is the federal government does not issue marriage licenses or do divorce law. It is not a federal issue. It is a traditional area of state regulation, as noted in the Comerica case. So ERISA does not preempt that. And then if ERISA doesn't preempt it, then Cozen's choice of law provision, Pennsylvania law, must apply and should be applied to, and they had a very reasonable, rational reason for doing it. They've got folks all over the country. And to the point that, say, a common law marriage in another jurisdiction wouldn't be honored here in Pennsylvania, I'm sure that if we did a little bit of digging, we'd find that under full faith and credit, Pennsylvania law recognizes marriages from other jurisdictions as long as they're not against the public policy of the state of Pennsylvania. So same-sex marriages or civil unions would not be recognized in Pennsylvania, but other marriages, opposite-sex marriages, would be. I do want to get to Illinois. Counsel for Tobitz was wrong that the Illinois Civil Union Law gives other jurisdictions same-sex marriages effect as marriages in Illinois. It does not. 750 ILCS 75/60 says very specifically those out-of-jurisdiction marriages are seen as civil unions in Illinois. So you are either married opposite sex in Illinois or you are civilly united. And usually same-sex, a few opposite-sex civil unions in Illinois. Moreover, the civil union law does not change marriage in Illinois. That needs to be made clear. Per 750 ILCS 75/20, the civil union law only it does not change that nature of marriage. It creates a parallel structure, but it does not abolish the current structure of marriage. Further, this issue of whether the Illinois civil union law applies retroactively, that is something that the claim there is that somehow the action of the Illinois General Assembly changed the beneficiary of this plan after the death of the plan participant. Because if they were not legally married or under this plan in September of 2010, the action of the Illinois General Assembly can't change that in June of 2011 to somehow now make them married, make Ms. Tobitz and Ms. Farley married after the fact. That doesn't comport with Illinois law, certainly, of retroactivity, and I can't imagine that it would be constitutional to change a contract, a private contract like that. And as well, the Illinois Civil Union Law, again, the previous cite we made, it applies to the laws of Illinois. It doesn't apply to private contracts. Certainly not contracts engaged in Pennsylvania and under Pennsylvania law and federal law. The reason I was objecting just a little bit earlier, I understand Human Rights Campaign's contention that you can extend same-sex benefits to same-sex folks with an ERISA plan. We agree with that. There is a provision, though, about the right of first refusal that is granted to a spouse and to an opposite-sex spouse only. And those were cited, actually, in the Cozen O'Connor, I believe, in their motion for judgment, I think pages 8 through 10.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, those sections still stand. And it was my understanding, consulting with members of the ERISA bar, that they felt, well, look, we can do a lot of things for same-sex couples. We can't do that right of first refusal because that is an encumbrance on the freedom of the plan participant to disperse their funds as they see fit. So, and that's, that private.
Doesn't
yes.
that then mean that spouse is heterosexual under your presentation?
In this plan where there was no distinction made, spouse must mean one man, one woman marriage. Otherwise, this ERISA plan runs afoul of the IRS code and ERISA itself and would lose their tax treatment. And I've got cites for that. I think they've been put forward to the court, but it's 29 U.S.C. 1055 sub B, sub 1, sub C, sub little I, and 1055 sub C. And then in the tax code, 26 U.S.C. 401 sub A, sub 11, sub B, sub triple I, sub big I, and then 26 U.S.C. 417. So those are the places. I mean, Your Honor, again, from our consultation with ERISA counsel, they feel we could do a lot for same-sex couples, but just not that right of first refusal. And so Cozen's plan is properly drawn, was correct in its understanding that they couldn't extend that right of first refusal to same-sex couples. And so for that reason, also, it buttresses our case that when they said spouse, they meant an opposite-sex spouse. Thank you, Your Honor.
Just one moment, since I think we have a little bit left. I only have one point to make regarding Baker versus Nelson. It was brought up earlier that we can't really get into the minds of the justices and what they did in summarily dismissing the case. That's not really what we do in a situation like this. We looked at the jurisdictional statement to see what all was brought in, and there were claims made on equal protection and due process. Under equal protection, there were even claims being made for a heightened level of scrutiny. There were claims made that the benefits were different and limited for same-sex couples. So I think in all of the relevant ways, Baker versus Nelson really is on on all fours with the situation that we have here, so there would be no equal protection or due process violation. And so we believe that this court would be bound by the summary dismissal in Baker versus Nelson. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Your Honor, if I heard the recent argument that was just made on behalf of the Farleys, I need to say something in rebuttal to that. If the argument was made, as I thought I heard it just now, that because our plan definition as drafted of spouse means people of the opposite sex, that means you do not have to go beyond the plan, I would point out that what we have said consistently is that the plan definition of spouse means people of the opposite sex because it was driven by our desire to have the plan be deemed qualified under ERISA, consistent with our understanding that DOMA required it to be spouses be people of opposite sex.
But that, nevertheless, what was written in that document
meant that
opposite sex spouse
because of the requirement of DOMA. If Your Honor were to say that DOMA is not applicable to this plan, I think our plan trustees would have not considered the question in that sense. In other words, no one has gone back to the trustees to say DOMA is not applicable. Now, what do you mean by spouse? Spouse was intended to mean, as I've stated, because of the belief that DOMA required it, and
but
in the absence
of the, at the time of the execution, the date that's put on that, and the date of Ms. Farley's demise, it's done, correct? You can't go back now and change it, can you?
I think there is authority as has been said to you by counsel for Dobitz, that the plan administrators have the ability to interpret their own plan. If they were to interpret their own plan today, they would interpret it to mean people of the opposite sex because they also would be told that DOMA requires that. If they were told that DOMA is inapplicable and that they're not required to so define spouse in order to have a qualified plan, they might come to a different conclusion.
Would it matter whether or not the funds would have been placed into the court or still in your possession?
It wouldn't matter, Your Honor. We would so advise you of if you asked us to make that determination, we would advise you of the determination. We would meet with the trustees and explain it to them, and then they would make that determination, and we would advise the court.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bader.
Your Honor, can I have 30 seconds for rebuttal?
Do you mind?
Go ahead.
Thank you.
I can wait.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to say that respond to the point made by counsel for the government about the House trumpeting the 11 circuits that apply a rational basis test. And it's not surprising that he would try to mute my trumpet because 11 circuits is a mighty horn. And he says, counsel says, well, those cases were decided based on Bowers, and Bowers got overruled by Lawrence. But I would point out that several of these cases were decided post-Lawrence, and that would include the First Circuit's Cook versus Gates case and the Ninth Circuit's Witt versus Air Force case. So then they argue, well, those are military cases. And then I would respond by saying, well, there are other cases post-Lawrence that are not in the military context, and that would include the 11th Circuit's Lofton decision and the Eighth Circuit's decision in Citizens for Equal Protection versus Bunning. So both before and after Lawrence, all the circuits agree that rational basis is the test. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
have a few things to respond to here. I'm going to start with the citation to Conkright that Mr. Breen mentioned, Conkright v. Frommert from the Supreme Court. And he said that Conkright stands for the proposition that a plan administrator's interpretation of the plan will not be disturbed if reasonable. But it's black-letter ERISA law that a plan administrator's interpretation is unreasonable if it is based on a mistake of law. The other point that I would make on that is that we have pointed out to the court in our brief that's docket number 92, the Gritzer case and the Munch case, M-O-E-N-C-H, of the Third Circuit, both of which say that if the trustee hasn't acted, the plan administrator hasn't acted, then they've forfeited the privilege to apply discretion. And that's what's happened here. Cozen has interpled the funds. They've said we're not going to arrive at an interpretation of our plan. We want the court to do it. And the Gritzer and Munch cases stand for the proposition that they forfeited the right to make that interpretation. Turning to the interpretation of the plan, the last thing I want to say about that is that I don't understand Mr. Feebach to be offering an interpretation of the plan. I thought what he was doing was suggesting what extrinsic evidence the court might consider if it determined that the plan was ambiguous, which is one of the questions that the court had posed to the parties. He had suggested that the intent of the plan's drafter with regard to the meaning of the term spouse would be relevant, but that's not correct. The Third Circuit said in Baldwin that expressions of subjective intent are not relevant to determining the meaning of an ambiguous plan term. What is relevant is objective manifestations of intent, and that would include the history that I cited earlier, that DOMA was already in place when this plan was adopted. It would include manifestations of intent such as Cozen's non-discrimination policy that's stated on its website, which says that it doesn't discriminate. It's a commendable policy. Cozen doesn't discriminate on the basis of gender or marital status or sexual preference or orientation. And that non-discrimination policy, Cozen says, applies to every aspect of the employment relationship. That's an objective manifestation of intent by Cozen to treat its gay and lesbian employees equally that the court would consider if it determined that the term spouse was ambiguous and needed to be interpreted with reference to the objective manifestations of the party's intent. Other objective manifestations that would be relevant would be how Cozen has administered the plan. If it believes that, if it's interpreting its plan to provide benefits only to opposite-sex spouses, what procedures does it have in place to determine the sex of a spouse before it pays a benefit? If Pennsylvania law is applicable, how has Cozen analyzed the validity of marriages under Pennsylvania law before paying out benefits? All of those would be objective manifestations of intent that would be relevant if the plan is ambiguous. As we've argued, the plan is not ambiguous because the plan term is defined as the person to whom the participant has been married for at least a year. And there is nothing in ERISA that purports to dictate to private employers how to define the term spouse in their pension plans. There's nothing in federal law, there's nothing in ERISA and nothing in the Internal Revenue Code that requires a private employer plan to employ a particular meaning of the term spouse. There's no provision in either statute that directs employers how to use that term. So it's really ludicrous to argue that what DOMA is requiring, that DOMA is requiring employers, as Ms. Hoffman said, to repeat the same benefits provisions two separate times just in order to avoid using the term spouse to refer to a same-sex spouse, and nothing in the law requires that. DOMA itself only affects federal laws and regulations, and there's nothing in ERISA that requires plans to use a particular meaning of the term spouse. Furthermore, we disagree with the United States about a plan's ability to provide those mandated benefits, survivor annuities, basically qualified joint survivor annuities and pre-retirement survivor annuities, and what has been referred to as the right of first refusal to same-sex spouses. There is nothing in ERISA or the code that precludes the provision of those benefits to same-sex spouses as spouses. ERISA and the code prescribe certain minimum benefits for spouses, and because we have to view those statutes through the lens of DOMA, those benefits are only required to be provided to opposite-sex spouses. That is true. But those requirements are a floor, not a ceiling. A plan remains free to extend those benefits to non-federally recognized spouses, same-sex spouses, so long as the rights of opposite-sex spouses are not impaired. And as Ms. Hoffman pointed out, nobody has two legal spouses. So there's no danger that providing those benefits, those mandatory benefits to a same-sex spouse, would ever cause an opposite-sex spouse to not get the benefit that the law requires. There is no form of benefit under this plan that cannot lawfully be provided to a same-sex spouse. Now, we've heard a lot about tax qualification, and our opponents argue that a plan can't qualify for favorable tax treatment if it uses the term spouse to include same-sex spouses, or if it provides a federally mandated benefit to someone who's not required to receive it. But tax qualification is not a defense to a benefits claim. A plan is required to pay benefits in accordance with its terms, regardless of IRS requirements. So even if they were right, and they're not, that tax qualification would be jeopardized by the provision of benefits to a same-sex spouse as such. Even if they were right about that, that's still not a basis to deny a claim. A plan cannot provide for a benefit on its face, and then when the beneficiary or participant applies for the benefit, say, oh, sorry, we can't provide that because of tax qualification. Tax qualification is a matter between the plan sponsor and the IRS, and it has no bearing on a benefits claim.
My understanding, Mr. Hubeck's argument is that's what motivated it to be drafted the way that it was drafted, and in drafting it that way, it was intended to be a spouse of the opposite sex.
Well, I understand that that's his argument, and certainly that would be extrinsic evidence going to intent, although it's not particularly relevant extrinsic evidence, because the only extrinsic evidence that the court should consider are objective manifestations, not subjective statements of what we meant to do. So, you know, if that's something that the court might consider, if the court determined that the language was ambiguous, but again, the court's really going to be looking to objective manifestations, not to explanations of subjective intent. I also want to point out, you know, by way of contrast, because we keep saying, oh, DOMA doesn't say anything about this, ERISA doesn't say anything about this, the code doesn't say anything about this, and eventually, you know, we're trying to prove a negative. But by way of contrast, you know, there is a provision in the Internal Revenue Code. It's section 7702, capital B, parens F, and we cited it in our brief. It's the provision that's at issue in the Dragovich case that we cited. And that's a provision where the Internal Revenue Code affirmatively says that states may not provide benefits to same-sex spouses in certain types of benefits plans. Specifically, what it says is that it deals with long-term care plans that states sponsor for their own employees. And what this provision of the Internal Revenue Code does is it provides a list of people who can be covered under such a plan, who can receive benefits under that type of state-sponsored plan. And the list is spouses and children and parents-in-law, and it goes on. But because we have to view that statute through the lens of DOMA, spouses in that statute means only opposite-sex spouses. And everybody agrees that that statute means that if a state provides benefits to same-sex spouses under its long-term care plan, it will not be a tax-qualified long-term care plan. There is no provision in the Internal Revenue Code, or for that matter in ERISA, that parallels that Internal Revenue Code provision that applies to state plans. There is nothing that says a a private employer plan will not be tax qualified if it provides benefits to somebody other than a DOMA spouse, a federally recognized spouse. So ERISA simply has nothing to say about the meaning of the term spouse in an ERISA plan. I also wanted to provide a brief addition here. Ms. Hoffman said correctly that the Internal Revenue Service article that was, it was called Retirement Topics, Qualified Joint Survivor Annuity, it is no longer on the, it, the text that we've been citing in the briefs is no longer on the website, and I wanted to point out that that was cited in the Human Rights Campaign's brief. It was also cited in Kozin's brief. It's at page 4 of 11 in document 70. So both of those citations are referring to text that the IRS has removed from its website. Okay. Lastly, I wanted to briefly come back to the breach of fiduciary duty claim. The statement in the summary plan description that Mr. Feebach pointed to that says federal laws may affect your rights is completely insufficient to meet the requirement of ERISA that a summary plan description describe circumstances, any circumstances that may result in disqualification or loss of a benefit. If being a same-sex spouse is a circumstance that may result in the loss of a benefit, then that's something that needed to be conveyed specifically in the summary plan description and not by an oblique reference to federal laws. Finally, I wanted to say a word about the beneficiary designation because it's come up a couple of times. The beneficiary designation is invalid for multiple reasons. You know, in addition to notarizing a signature line with no signature, it purports to designate each of the parents as a primary beneficiary to receive 100% of the benefit, which is impossible. You know, there's no way that the plan administrator could follow this beneficiary designation. And because Ms. Farley was an accomplished attorney, as everybody has said, it's really very distressing to contemplate the circumstances that would have, if she participated in preparing this beneficiary designation, that would have caused her to prepare a designation that's so woefully inadequate. But the bottom line is that the plan is clear. The plan provides benefits to spouses without qualification.
Well, let me just stop you and back up just a second.
Yes.
Are you saying that if there was a legitimate issue, well, let me start at this point. If the court does not rule that it's not violation of ERISA, or better still, let me put this right there. If the court rules that DOMA is intact, it's constitutional, then the second argument would be that, well, let's look at the actual document itself, and there's an issue with how this beneficiary form was completed. That's another issue?
No, I am not.
Okay.
If the court holds that the term spouse in the plan means opposite sex spouse, and it means that because it's compelled to DOMA by DOMA, and DOMA is constitutional. That is, we lose on every single one of our arguments.
Well, so there's not any issue with the beneficiary form?
There's not an issue with the beneficiary designation because if that were the court's ruling, then the parents, Mr. and Mrs. Farley, would be entitled to the benefit by operation of the default beneficiary provision of the plan. The default beneficiary provision of the plan says that in the absence of a valid beneficiary designation, assuming no beneficiary designation, the benefit will be paid to the spouse, if no spouse, then to the children, if no children, then to the parents. So the argument here is that Ms. Tobitz takes the benefit because she is the spouse. But if Your Honor rules against us on all those issues, as I described,
well, I
then it would go to the far
argument.
List.
I thought just at the end you said, well, there's an issue here with the how the name was written and on the beneficiary form.
You know, the plan administrator or the court would have to determine how the benefit is allocated as between the Farleys. That we're not taking a position on that. Yeah, it's the default beneficiary designation that would apply. But the bottom line is that Ms. Tobitz is a spouse within the plain terms of the plan. It would have been perfectly easy for Cozen to say that to define its term spouse as the person to whom the participant has been married for at least a year and who is of the opposite sex of the participant, or and who is a spouse under the Defense of Marriage Act, or and who is a spouse under Pennsylvania law. Cozen didn't do any of those things. The plan doesn't incorporate any of that language. And because the plain language of the plan provides this benefit to a spouse, and Ms. Tobitz is a spouse. She's a spouse under Canadian law. She's a spouse under Illinois law. She's entitled to receive the benefit in this case, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you need to hear any more from us, Your Honor? Or?
I think not.
I think we hit all those arguments as well.
I appreciate it. All right. Let me first state to all of you who have presented arguments, as well as those who have submitted writings, this is a very difficult task, but I welcome the difficulty because counsel's representation is so superb. And I can't thank you enough for being so committed to your respective positions and putting forth an incredibly competent and superb effort, and I thank you so much for that. And I will get you a decision on this as soon as is practicable. With matters adjourned, thank you very much.
All right.